Yeah, let's do it. Here we are. How are you? Oh, God, how are you? New seating. All right, ladies and gentlemen, if we can get the committee going. Scott, Brad, we good? Tom, we good? So let me introduce myself. For those of you who don't know, my name is Jimmy Yee. I have been the facilitator for the last six meetings for AB 617. For those of you who are, I see some new faces in the crowd, just a little housekeeping. The ladies in the men's room are just to my left, right off the entryway. Meetings, we try to end promptly at 7:30. The public will have an opportunity towards the end of tonight's session to give comment. If you have not registered or signed in, please do. We need you on the mailing list so you get notification, and we'd also love your email, obviously, as the form to communicate with you and any other additional information that you want to provide. We also have headsets here for those who are Spanish speaking only. We've supplied those. We've got some committee members that only speak Spanish, so we want to make sure that nothing's lost in translation. We've been averaging about between 17 and 20 members of attendance. See, we're a little sparse tonight, but just bear with us. The members hopefully will be coming in as we get going. The one thing for those of you who are new, we normally have a horseshoe. We decided to change it up. We think there's a little bit more engagement, and we wanted to make the process a lot easier for the committee. Just two other introductions, Cynthia Martinez, our copious note taker, and Cody is in the back. For committee members, we're just going to basically be sharing mics. We've got four presentations tonight. We really want to do a deep dive. There's agendas and all the PowerPoints that are being shown tonight in the back. So if you want to flip through as the narration's going on, please go to the back to get your packets. But with further, any other questions from committee members? Okay, so let me just jump in. We've got health effects of air contaminants. Heather Bolstead with the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. She's got a PowerPoint. And if we can just kind of hold off questions from committee's members until she gets through. Heather, it's your show.
Thank you. Is this working? Hi, good evening. Thank you all for being here. So I'm Heather. I work for OEHA, which is one of the, I think they're going to adjust the light so you can see this better. Great. One of the six parts of the California Environmental Protection Agency. So the Air Resources Board is one of our sister agencies. And our headquarters are here in this big building in Sacramento. But OEHA also has an office in Oakland. So this is where I am in Oakland. And I just want to put up our respective missions, and you're welcome to read that, but essentially we want to restore, protect, and enhance the environment to ensure public health, environmental quality, and economic vitality. And OEHA's slogan is Science for a Healthy California. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about what exactly risk is, toxicity, and exposure, and how my department determines toxicity and the factors that influence toxicity. And then get into how we derive the health guidance values that are used in estimating risk. And then some of the specific health concerns with some of the chemicals that will be measured in the air here in Shafter. And then how we determine risk from the actual monitoring data that will be produced. And then get into a little bit of the improvements that are seen in health after air quality has been improved. So first, what is risk? Risk is a combination of two factors, toxicity and exposure. So water is not very toxic, but if you're exposed to enough, there'll be some risk. In contrast, the botulinum toxin that causes botulism, you only have to be exposed to a tiny amount for toxicity to occur because it's that potent. So toxicity reflects how dangerous the chemical is, and we use health guidance values as a metric to reflect that. For exposure, the question is, do you actually come in contact with it? Hopefully you don't come into contact with the botulinum toxin on a daily basis. And the question of exposure is answered by the air monitoring data. Is it actually in the air? And at what frequency and at what level? So some possible routes of exposure to air contaminants are shown here, or I should say sources of air pollution. And we'll get into several of these in more detail. So first, how do we determine the toxicity of a chemical? Well, we develop what I mentioned, these metrics called health guidance values. But we have two types. One type is for non-cancer effects, like asthma, and these are called reference exposure levels, and they're the amount of chemical in the air that is likely to not cause non-cancer health effects, so to be without risk, even in sensitive populations like asthmatic children and pregnant women. So the goal when we derive a reference exposure level is to protect everyone in the population. For cancer, we use unit risks or cancer potency factors, and essentially that describes the increase in cancer risk per unit of exposure. So an example would be if you have 1 ppb of something in the air, it would be the increase in cancer risk per ppb of exposure. So we have to take into account several things that can influence toxicity. One is the amount, which is pretty straightforward, but another is the length of exposure. And so we'll talk about that in a little more detail. And then also sensitivity, because the population varies and their susceptibility to pollutants also varies. So another important aspect of toxicity is that the effects and severity can change with dose. They're not necessarily the same effect that just gets severe, the greater the exposure. So ethanol is a great example where the effects change the more you consume. So initially, according to this graph, there's giddiness followed by sleep and eventually unconsciousness and then death. So the seriousness of the effect changed as the dose increased, but the effect also changed. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. And then toxicity depends on the length of exposure. So this is a picture, and I don't know why this person's throwing a bag of grain on the other person, but it's a good figure for explaining this concept. So this would hurt. Whereas if the bag, same bag, was broken open and poured little by little over the same person, that person could withstand it. And it's kind of the same with chemicals in general. So we develop reference exposure levels for each of these kind of situations. So for brief exposures, we develop what's called acute RELs. So these are to protect against occasional one-hour exposures to the chemical. For moderate exposure, we develop 8-hour RELs. And those are for repeated 8-hour exposures like you would have if you were attending school or at your occupation. And then finally, for constant exposure or chronic exposure, we have chronic RELs. And these are designed to protect against 1 year to a lifetime of exposure. And so that would be relevant to something that's in the air in a community that you're exposed to, where you live, where you work. It's a fairly constant factor. Another concept is related to the sensitivity issue and the variability. So as the dose or exposure increases, more people will be affected. And that's what's shown in this figure. So from left to right, as the amount of chemical exposure increases, the effect of the chemical and the number of people affected will increase. So down here, we have someone who's affected at a fairly low level, and you increase the exposure, and more people are affected. This person is highly sensitive and is bedridden, whereas you get all the way to the top, and this person hasn't been affected, so we would call them resistant. So people differ. Some are more sensitive than others, like children, pregnant women, the elderly. It depends on many factors, and others are more resistant. So how do we develop health guidance values? Well, it's a process, but I've tried to break it down into its steps here. So first, we review all of the information on health effects that's available, whether it's from controlled animal studies in a laboratory or epidemiology studies looking at air pollution and health impacts in people. And these days, more and more, we're getting data from the petri dish, so in vitro studies, to try to reduce the use of animals and to be able to test chemicals more quickly. So once we've done that review, we identify the most sensitive effects from the information. So what is the effect that is caused at the lowest exposure level? And then we determine the relationship between the amount of chemical and the effect. So how the dose and the effect relate to each other. Is it a steep relationship or is it a gradual increase? And then we determine the amount of the chemical that causes a specific effect. So by specific effect, I mean a certain degree. So like a 10% decrease in body weight in an animal study is considered adverse. For cancer, it may be a 5% increase in cancer risk, that sort of thing. So once we have the amount that's associated with our specific effect of interest, then we adjust it. Maybe we only have an oral study, but we want to determine the toxicity by the inhalation route, so we may have to adjust it. Species, rodents don't typically breathe through their mouths like we do, so we have to adjust for the fact that our lungs and respiratory tract are different from the rodents. And then also length of exposure. You may not have a long-term animal study. It may only be 3 weeks, so then you have to adjust it to make sure if you're deriving a chronic REL, that it will likely protect humans exposed for a lifetime. And then there are all sorts of other adjustments for uncertainty, like time differences, like I mentioned. Maybe there's missing information, like this chemical hasn't been studied for developmental toxicity. And then also species. Maybe you're not quite sure the differences between the animal that it was tested in and humans in terms of sensitivity. So we kind of incorporate some uncertainty factors into the derivation to make sure we've protected against these possibilities. So then we adjust the amount for differences in sensitivity between people. So essentially the population variability. And finally, we get the health guidance value. So I just want to take you through a quick hypothetical example. Let's say that 1,000 parts per billion, or ppb, of a chemical causes our specific effect in the rat. But we predict, based on differences between rats and humans, that humans would be more sensitive. And so we apply a tenfold factor and divide 1,000 ppb by 10 to get 100. And then let's say there's no developmental study on this compound. So we want to make sure that if there's any potential for developmental toxicity, that we've protected against it. So we're going to divide by 10. And then finally, we'll divide by 10 to protect asthmatic children. And these numbers can vary. There are not always 10. But after dividing by 1,000, we get 1 ppb, and that's our guidance value. So you can see that if it's incorporated several what we call uncertainty factors, or they reflect variability as well. So I want to get into particulate matter. This figure shows a human hair and the relative size of the PM10 and PM2.5 particles. So PM10 includes dust, pollen, mold, and that's particles with a diameter of 10 microns or less. And a micron is a millionth of a meter. And PM2.5 similarly has a diameter of 2.5 microns and below. So why is this important? Well, because PM2.5 can reach deep into the lung, unlike PM10. So this figure shows that PM10 and up may lodge in the nose and then be coughed up, sneezed out, blown out, but it doesn't really make it any farther than the nasal cavity. And then for PM2.5 to about 10, those yellow particles here make it down a little deeper. But PM2.5, and in particular PM1 and smaller, will make it down to the gas exchange region and the lungs. So that's a concern. So some of the effects of short-term exposure to PM2.5 are respiratory irritation, decreased lung function, mainly respiratory symptoms. But both short and long-term exposure have been associated with severe effects, including premature death, cardiovascular mortality and hospitalizations, and respiratory and asthma hospitalizations. So some of the sensitive populations are those I've mentioned: elderly, those with pre-existing heart and lung conditions, infants and children. Exposure can increase the frequency of childhood illnesses. It can decrease lung function growth. And in pregnant women, exposure has been found to be associated with decreased birth weight and also preterm birth or premature birth. So diesel exhaust contributes to PM2.5. And for non-cancer, some of the concerns are very similar to PM2.5. Actually, a lot of what we know about diesel exhaust comes from what we know about just PM2.5 in general. So respiratory effects, also other severe effects like increased hospitalizations, asthma attacks. Sensitive populations, similar to those for PM2.5. And then cancer. Diesel exhaust is associated with an increased cancer risk. And the Air Resources Board has estimated that the average Californian's risk of cancer from air pollution, about 70% of it comes from diesel exhaust. So our health guidance values for diesel exhaust, for non-cancer, the chronic rel is 5 micrograms per meter cubed. So a microgram being a millionth of a gram. And the effect that this rel is based on is changes that were observed in the rat lung in a controlled laboratory study. For cancer, the unit risk is an increase in cancer cases of 0.003 per microgram per meter cubed of exposure. And then the inhalation cancer potency factor, which is another way to describe the increase in cancer risk, is there. And then this was based on lung tumors observed in workers exposed to diesel exhaust throughout their occupation. And I want to get into wood smoke a little bit, because residential wood burning contributes to particulate pollution, particularly in the winter. So wood smoke contains thousands of chemicals, but the most concerning are the particulates, like I mentioned, carbon monoxide, irritants like acrolein and formaldehyde, and those may trigger asthma attacks. But there are also carcinogens, including polyaromatic hydrocarbons like PAHs. And what's interesting is not only does it contribute to outside air pollution, but the air pollution outside from residential wood burning can infiltrate and contribute to indoor air pollution. And Air District program to reduce residential wood burning during days when the air quality is forecasted to be poor was associated with decreased hospitalizations for cardiovascular disease. So the actual health impact of this program was seen. In terms of metals, there are a number of metals that can be in air. And this just shows some example health effects of some metals. So on the left in red, we had the cancer effects. So lung cancer, not surprising given that we're talking about exposure via the respiratory route. Adrenal cancer is associated with cobalt, kidney cancer associated with lead. And then a number of other systems are impacted with non-cancer effects. So the nervous system, the liver, all sorts of systems. And these effects shown here are just what our RELs or unit risks are based on. They're not all the effects of the chemical, but they're likely the most sensitive or most concerning. In terms of volatile organic compounds, so volatile meaning they're a gas at ambient temperature and pressure, like where we're all sitting here, and organic meaning they contain carbon. So these are some examples that are likely to be detected in air at some time or another in the state. They've been associated with nasal tumors. Typically, nasal tumors you see in animal studies, again, because they breathe solely through their noses. In the human, you may see a lung tumor from the same chemical, just because of the differences between the species. Kidney cancer, leukemia, and then again on the right are some of the non-cancer effects. Not surprisingly, respiratory system is affected by many compounds. And again, this is just a subset. I just wanted to get a little bit into ammonia because I know that's a local issue. So let's cut off a little bit. But ammonia is a colorless gas and it has a really sharp and pungent, irritating odor. And in the San Joaquin Valley, dairies contribute about 38% of the ammonia, fertilizer about 36%, and then non-dairy livestock, 19%. And then there are some other smaller contributing sources. So the problem with ammonia is it contributes to particulate matter. So it's involved in the formation of particulate matter. And for acute exposures, the REL is based on respiratory and eye irritation in humans. The chronic REL is kind of based on the same thing, symptoms of exposure and effects on lung function in workers. And susceptible populations, similar to what I've talked about previously, are those with asthma and other respiratory conditions, including cardiopulmonary disease. So once we have air concentrations and the RELs or the unit risks, how do we determine the risk? Well, for non-cancer, we look at, is the exposure above or below the reference exposure level? It's pretty straightforward. If it's below, there's minimal concern. If it's above, there may be concern, but it depends how much above it is. Because as I showed you, we incorporate several uncertainty factors to try to make sure that where we're missing information, we're unsure. Also to account for variability, we've got all the bases covered. And another thing you have to keep in mind, and I'm not going to talk about this here, is the cumulative impacts. We're not all exposed to one chemical. We're exposed to multiple chemicals that may impact the kidney, may impact the respiratory system, may cause cancer. So in doing a community risk assessment, we have to take that into account. So for cancer, we look at the increased cancer risk due to that chemical. And if it's higher, there'll be greater concern. And some policy decisions have to be made about what is an acceptable increase in cancer risk. And again, for a community health assessment, we would look at cumulative cancer risk rather than just risk from one chemical. So what does reducing PM levels mean? Well, in Utah Valley, a steel mill shutdown reduced particulate matter and respiratory hospital admissions. In Ireland, when they banned coal sales, particulate matter was reduced and death from heart and lung disease was reduced significantly. I think it was on the order of 10 to 15%. In Southern California, a study found that children who moved to less polluted areas had improved lung function growth, and those that moved to more polluted areas had decreased lung function growth rates. And a review of cardiovascular mortality and particulate matter in 51 cities across the country found that over the years, as PM levels have been reduced, life expectancy has increased as a result. And similarly, since diesel particulate matter is associated with cancer risk, decreasing the diesel exhaust PM level is expected to also decrease cancer risk. And this is the case in California. The average diesel exhaust PM levels have gone down over time, so our estimated cancer risk associated with that has gone down over time. And that is it. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yes, several questions. The you mentioned briefly cumulative impacts.
Yes.
So in a place like Shafter, works a person like myself who works, who's been outside most of my life as a farmer, I taught school for a while too, but then I'd farm before and after. Anyway, a lot of people are exposed to the outdoor air, and so we have many days, you know, in the summer of ozone levels above the health standard. We have even more days or many days in the winter, or let's say the annual average for PM 2.5 is close to 50% above the health standard of 12 micrograms. And then we're exposed to pesticides and who knows what else. So how do you begin to calculate the health risk for a person who's outside working under those conditions?
Well, that's a complicated question. You know, you could do it individual by individual, but I think the state of the art for doing it accurately and reflecting the whole community is to look at distributions and the variability in the population. So those working inside in an office would have less outdoor exposure versus those that are outdoor. So we can take that into account to some degree, but to do a community level assessment, that's a really good question, you know, because each individual is going to vary. We do try to make the most protective assumptions. So, for example, if you're outside working, depending on the type of job, it would be associated with a different breathing rate. So if it's really high intensity, you'd have a higher breathing rate. You would breathe in more of chemicals. So we would take that into account as well. I don't know if that...
But you haven't really done a comprehensive study of people who work outside in a place like Kern County?
There may be studies, and I can look into that for you.
So another question.
Mm-hmm.
If you have you're under Cal EPA, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Jared's your boss right now? Or there's...
Yeah, ultimately.
There's no board associated with... OEHA?
No.
Okay. And so when you have a disagreement with DPR on the safe level of a pesticide, of a particular pesticide exposure, how does DPR get to win over OEHA? Which happened with the 1,3-D or Talon.
Right. Well, I think DPR has the regulatory authority. We advise on health-based recommendations. So by law, we're required, OEHA is required to peer review DPR's assessments. So I appreciate your question, though.
And then finally, you mentioned a study linking no-burn days to fewer hospital admissions. Was that done here in the San Joaquin Valley? And who did that study? Or where can I find it?
It's in the American Journal of Public Health. I can send it to you. And it was done by ARB.
It was done by ARB?
Yes.
Not the Air District?
The Air District may have supplied the data, but the health effects analysis was done by ARB.
Okay. Well, I'd like to see a link to that study. So.
Okay.
Because I'm not sure what it was called.
I think I usually use PubMed as a resource for studies, but if you just Google, or what's it? There we go. Yap and Garcia, 2015. But I can also send it to you.
And finally, when you mentioned ammonia, and you mentioned fertilizer, dairies, as both major sources, some of those are seasonal. And our worst PM2.5, when secondary ammonia particles are part of the mix, is in the winter. So has anybody looked at who is contributing the most ammonia to an area like Kern County in the winter months when PM2.5 is actually quite high? Because I'm doing a lot of fertilizing in the summer or right now, and we don't have much PM2.5 issues, but I know I'm putting ammonia into the air.
Right. It also depends on the nitric oxide level, because ammonia is reacting with nitric oxides to form the PM2.5. So there are multiple factors at play. In terms of the most important sources during the winter, I'm not sure.
See, that's important to us, because if we want to look at a way of reducing PM2.5, it may turn out that ammonia from dairies is actually saturating our air in the wintertime because they're perhaps pumping lagoons out during that time, and it may be by far the largest source of ammonia. And we know that ammonium nitrate and ammonium sulfate is two-thirds of our PM2.5 in the winter when we have all these violations. So we need more information on that. We can't recommend doing anything about ammonia from a dairy unless we know exactly how it's affecting our air locally here in the winter.
Right. So there should be data on the seasonality of the ammonia levels and possibly some estimates of the relative contribution of the different sources. So I could also look into that.
Yeah, if you can find that for us, that would help.
A couple of questions. I'm assuming, or at least at one time, I kept fairly close track of cancer rates per thousand in the various communities in the valley. Do we have that? Is there a big difference between this community and other communities up and down the valley that might be affected by these contaminants?
I'm not aware of any increased cancer risk that has been termed like a cancer cluster. I know Kettleman City was investigated for that. It's very difficult to determine, though, with smaller populations. It's easier to see when you have a larger population. But I'm not sure if they've been able to see an increased cancer risk in the valley.
From community to community, one having more cases than another.
I'm not sure.
I know they are reported and by age groups. And I'm wondering if we couldn't maybe have someone look into that. And I don't know that it's kept up to date, but I know that information is available. You know how many cancer cases there were.
Right, the SEER database is the national database where cancer cases are entered. And I don't think cancer risk is part of CalN virus screen. Asthma rates.
But the actual cases are reported. The actual cases of cancer within the various communities.
Yes.
Jimmy, I'd like to have someone put that down as an ask.
Okay. Cynthia.
And then one other. Well, Another thing that just for my clarification, when we're looking at the RELs, mm-hmm. can you explain that just real quickly? What an REL is?
Is the level for a non-cancer effect, the level in the air that's anticipated to be without risk.
Risk.
Even for sensitive members of the population.
Okay. And then as the concentration goes up, there's regardless of who you are, it reaches a level that it's a problem. Or
yeah, you might have a plateau where everybody's affected at a certain level.
Okay.
Is that what you're getting
yes.
at?
Yes. Yeah. No, and so the level that is established as the maximum level when it becomes a problem, where does it fit in that scheme of things? Is it
well, we are not trying to protect against the most severe endpoint. So, for example, like with ammonia, we don't want, you know, respiratory distress. We want to protect against irritation before it gets to that point.
Right.
So that's why we look for the most sensitive endpoint
okay.
in the animal or the human studies and protect against that.
And then there are safety factors that are applied to
yes,
that.
Yes. And different agencies use different safety factors. In OEHA, well, it depends on the program within OEHA, but we may use 30 as an intra, so within species variability to reflect human to human variability.
Okay.
A lot of other organizations use 10.
Okay. And then my last, it may be more of a comment than a question, but as we're looking at this community and what this particular AB 617's purpose is, it is to look at the things that create risks for this community and what we might be able to do about that. And so there's a lot of things around us, a lot of dairies around us, that may or may not impact this community. And I would want to caution everyone about trying to apply something 10 miles away that has almost no impact on us. So, and that's I don't want to get too far out for this committee. I want to know what affects me and my neighbors.
Right. But just because it's 10 miles doesn't mean it doesn't
No, I understand that. And if it does, if it affects me and my neighbors, then we're
yeah.
interested.
Well, and thankfully we can actually determine the biggest sources based on the levels in the air and maybe combined with some air modeling.
Okay.
And then also source attribution methods, which is like, for example, looking at CO2 levels, you can see what kind of isotopes are in there and estimate where the CO2 came from.
Okay.
It's kind of like a fingerprint.
All right.
Did it come from fossil fuels or maybe that's with methane, sorry, not with CO2.
Okay, I'd like to understand how that's actually going to happen as we set up our monitoring program. Then.
The source attribution methods?
Yeah.
I think that's more on the analytical side. So as a toxicologist, I will get the data and have to, you know, like this was the 24-hour level, this is the average annual level, compare it to the health criteria. But the lab should, if the proper methods are used, those kind of source attribution methods can be done.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything else, John? Okay. Anyone else from the committee? Okay, Heather, thank you very much.
Yep.
She's not going anywhere,
nope.
So the public will have an opportunity towards the end of tonight. So thank you very much, Heather. So you're all familiar with Brian. Yeah. There you go. You're all familiar with Brian Clements, Technical Programs Manager for the district, and Alejandra from CARB. They've both been here. They want to give you an update. Brian, if you want to kick this off, and then CARB will backstop it, but we're going to talk about mobile and stationary sources. Brian, go ahead.
Good evening, Brian Clements, Technical Services Manager at the district. And I'm going to continue the technical update for our stationary sources that we've been doing. A little bit more on the inventory that we've developed, and then also the related website tools that we have on our website and that we're continuing to update. So the first thing is that the district is updating the stationary source inventory for the 2018 calendar year data. We're currently processing that information, and that information will be available later on this year. So that the way that process works is, first of all, the calendar year has to finish, then we survey all the facilities in the district. There's some time that it takes for that information to come into the district. We go through that data, and then we'll have it available. It's typically midsummer, early fall when that's available. Until that time comes, we have the previous 5 years of emissions inventory available, the 2013 and 2017 data, and that's currently displayed on our website, the one shown on the slide here. That information currently contains our criteria emissions, the air toxics emissions, which is also important, is not on the website yet, but that will be coming soon. And we'll let the committee know when that's available. And then based on the feedback we've been receiving throughout this process, we're continuing to update the tools that are available on the website, such as the maps. So the updates that are in progress for the maps are, we're adding sensitive receptor layers. They'll be visible in some of the screenshots that I'll show in a minute. That I'll show you in a minute. But we'll have individual layers that you can toggle on and off for the different pollutants, such as PM2.5, VOC, NOx, toxics, and so on. And we wanted to also have it a little more visual, where you'll be able to, when you look at the map and see like facility markers, you'll be able to get a little bit more feel of what those emissions are and what the magnitude of those emissions are. So the markers will now indicate the relative magnitude of the mass emissions that each facility will be emitting. And we want to do the same thing for the area source categories and mobile source emissions as well. This also includes toxics as well. So our website will, at the end of the day, have all the compiled information for mobile, stationary, and area sources, as well as visual tools regarding those inventories. Just a quick emission source summary. These pie charts here represent the percent of emissions broken down by category of source, stationary, mobile, and area, and by pollutant. For now, we have PM 2.5, VOCs, and NOx. But we felt it's important to capture them all in one place and continue to update these. They're a work in progress. And we'll hear more about the green and yellow areas of those pie charts from ARB in a minute. As far as the map updates, this is a screenshot of what we're proposing for the sensitive receptor layers. You can see here, based on the legend on the side, we have the public schools, private schools, medical facilities, and care facilities represented by their different icons. And we also plan to add other layers where maybe you can see residential and industrial zones a little better. And this is a screenshot of how all those layers will look together. You can, at the top right, there's a layers tab that you can actually, toggle on and off those different layers. And then the next slide has a screenshot of those same layers still on, but we also added the facilities in there. This screenshot here is for PM 2.5, so any facility emitting 2.5 in this map. This map happens to be Fresno, but it gives you a feel for what the functionality is going to look like. So depending on the layer that you select for the pollutant, any facility or type of source emitting that type of pollutant will show up on the map. Now, this screenshot here is the perpendicular or bird's eye view of the community, so you can't really tell about the relative magnitude of those emissions. And that's the way we've had the map up until this point. We're playing around with a display on that. We are trying larger circles for higher emitting facilities, but with so many facilities on the map, it becomes difficult to see. So we're proposing more of a three-dimensional display, which on the next slide, you can start to get a feel for how that looks. This screenshot here represents emissions again, where the discs or cylinders are proportional to the amount of pollution they're emitting into the air. And then once multiple layers are toggled on like this, you'll be able to gain perspective on the relative amounts of emissions from facility to facility, as well as how close they are to certain sensitive receptors. And then the map will be fully functional as well, as far as zooming in and out and rotating it and raising the view up, down, left, right, and so on. And then the other thing is you'll still be able to, like we currently have, you'll still be able to click on the facility markers, any one of those cylinders, and a call-out box will appear with the facility's information, name and type of facility, the actual emissions, and other information. And then same thing for this slide is like the previous slide, but the example was VOC emissions. The previous one was PM2.5. But again, the height of the cylinders is relative to how much emissions are being put into the air from that facility. This is a representation of our stationary source facilities. But again, we want to, at the end of the day, have mobile source emissions, area sources, and toxics represented as well. And plan to have these features up on the live version of our map on our website soon. And that's the last slide I had on inventory, and I'll pass it over to Alejandra to talk about ARB's site.
So let me try and switch to my presentation real quick. Yeah. Okay. So hi, everyone. My name's Alejandra Cervantes, and I work with the Emission Inventory Group at the California Air Resources Board. And I am here today with my colleague, Adrian Kayabab. He's sitting over there in the back, waving. So, and if you guys have any questions related to inventory, us too can try and help you out. So I'm just going to give you guys an update of what we've been doing for the Shafter community, and hopefully we can answer some of your guys' questions. So we're still working on developing and finalizing the inventory. We're working with with the district staff, and hopefully over the next couple of weeks we'll be able to finalize all of those numbers, and the district can upload all that information into the mapping tool. So we've already received some feedback from some community members, and we've incorporated that into the emission inventory. But if you guys have any other feedback, you guys are welcome to add to send that information over. So the totals right here show the emission totals for stationary area, off-road mobile, and on-road mobile for the adopted community boundary. And we can see the percent contribution for each of those categories to the total emissions within the community. Right now, we're just showing you guys totals for PM2.5, NOx, ROG, and ammonia. But once we finalized all of the emission totals, we'll be able to show you the rest of the criteria pollutants and for each of these categories, and also a better breakdown of what's the information within each of these main categories. So we're still working with the district on figuring out which are the emissions that can be moved from an area source down to a point But for now, I wanted to show this this map that shows the distribution of the PM2.5 emissions in that 7-mile radius around Shafter. The red cell shows the top 40% emissions of PM2.5, and we can see that it's located at the center where there's the highest activity going on in the community. These charts right here show what are those area source emissions coming from, what are the biggest contributors to the community in total. So for NOx, we can see that most of the emissions are coming from food and agricultural processing and residential fuel combustion. And for PM2.5, we can see that farming operations, which is made out of harvesting operations, tilling, and livestock husbandry, make up a big chunk of PM2.5 emissions, and as well as paved road dust and fugitive windblown dust. So these are the main contributors. After that, we have cooking emissions, which it's mostly contributed by commercial cooking rather than residential cooking. That's a 6%, I believe. Yeah, 6%? I can't. Yeah, 6% contribution to the total emissions within the community. And for ammonia, we have the biggest contributors from farming operation and fertilizers. The map on the right, can we move? The map on the right, it's a little bit out of center from the projector, but the map on the right side shows the distribution of residential wood combustion and the emissions being PM2.5. And this takes into account fireplaces and wood stoves. When we're looking at the off-road emissions, similarly, we're trying to move those from, rather than having in the grid, into the location, but we're still working out which are those locations that, how we're gonna move in those emissions and how much of those emissions are allocated to the location. So right now we're just having it in the grid. And the main contributors for Shafter is farm equipment and off-road equipment when it comes to NOx and diesel PM10, and we do have a couple of PM emissions from aircraft. And the map on the right shows the distribution of the diesel PM10 emissions throughout the community. Here we have the on-road distribution within the community, and these emissions it's pretty much looks at every single road and what's the contribution of emissions within those road. The red, as you can see, the red shows the top 20% emissions in the community, and most of these emissions are, depending on the pollutant, either they're coming from heavy duty or light duty vehicles. And that's all I have for you guys. Is there any questions?
Ariana, would you mind? Thank you. Any questions from the committee? John?
Disbursement of 2.5 and all of the pollutants?
So the emissions by grid, they're based on the state implementation planning work done at a regional model. So we're looking, based on how those emissions are dispersed, we're looking only at the emissions that are occurring or the grids that are within the Shafter community.
No, but when I look at these grids, they're scattered. They're scattered over 7 miles, and I was not under the impression that we have monitoring stations at each one of those. So what I'm trying to get at is how do we know that these pollutants are coming from these grids?
So,
So it's not necessarily modeling, but it's also it can be, but it's also, you know, coming from various different, you know, aspects and agencies and ways of reporting.
How much
it's emissions inventory based, so there's processes and protocols to collect emissions inventory depending on the type of source that we're talking about.
How much of it is left up to the judgment of the modeler?
So do you want to talk about the grids?
So each of these, as Brian said, each of these sources has a certain methodology related to them. And based off of that, those methodologies are based off of different sources of data. And the reason we're doing it in a 1K modeling, 1K grid, is to better disperse those emissions. And the way we do it is we looked at the different sources that are occurring within that community. And Adrian wants to add a little bit more to that.
Why don't you introduce yourself? Adrian Kiabia with CARB. I work with Alejandra. So the answer to your question is there are several different methodologies that we use, like Alejandra said, but this is made up of emission factors. So for instance, let's just make up for gas stations, for instance. If we know a gas station has certain throughput, we have emission factors that were measured and calculated. So we know the amount of fuel going through a gas station, and we can apply these emission factors to get emissions for them. And then instead of having them typically in most cases, gas stations are considered an area source. I think in San Joaquin Valley, they actually handle it as a point source. But if we were going to switch it to from an area source to a point source, what we do is apply the emission factors to the throughput, and you get the emissions. And then we also have what we call spatial surrogates, where the actual gas stations are located within your community. And so we know that emissions occur for that gas station at that point. And then we can put that into what we call our modeling grid, which is the 1K. And so those emissions get allocated to that 1K grid. So we do that for all of the emissions that occur that you see there. So for farming, we'll do that. We'll know where the location of all the farms are, and we'll apply the emission factors that we have for it. And with the assumed throughput or whatever the metric is for measuring what's going on, the activity at the farm. And that's done at a regional level, but we do know the locations of the farm, so that gets allocated, and that's how it gets allocated to the grid. Does that make sense?
And yes, I think it does. But your source information this is a fairly large area, and at least based on my experience in the area, there are, you know, grid. I'm assuming there are 1 kilometer grids. Is that when we're talking about 1K grids? I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, so we have, it's 1 by 1 kilometer grids.
1 by 1 kilometers? Yeah. Okay, so I'm assuming that there's a database that you guys have that you, of each one of those those square kilometers that says this is what's in it, and then there's an allocation of whatever the air emissions are based on what's in it.
That's correct.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Hang on, Tom. Gustavo, you want to chime in?
Yes. Thank you guys both for the presentations. They're pretty cool. On the update. So the sensor receptors and the sensor receptors and emission sources map. Those are pretty cool one. But is there a reason why we're not looking at Shafter versus Fresno? Is that information not available yet?
Yeah. Neither Fresno nor Shafter is up on our website yet. This is just a mock-up of the model we're working on.
Okay.
But yes, of course, Shafter will be up as soon as when we're ready to put those map tools live. Fresno and Shafter will be ready together.
Cool.
Yeah.
And then on the second set of slides for the cylinders or the emission cylinders. So when you, like, once this is live, if you were to click on, like, say that one individual blue cylinder that was taller than the rest, is that one business, or is that, like, a
Correct.
Conglomeration of businesses?
Correct. No, that's, we'll have one of those for each.
So each one would be an individual source?
Permanent facility, yeah.
Okay, cool. Thank you. And for Alejandra, So on the same question here, so one question is on the RO, in the third slide, ROG, reactive organic gases, I'm sorry, but is that different from VOCs?
No, it's pretty much the equivalent. We just usually call them ROGs.
Okay, so ROGs and VOCs.
Yeah, they're pretty similar.
Almost pretty much the same. Okay, yeah. Cool. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think that was pretty much it. Just some clarifying questions.
Thanks, Gustavo. Bianca.
I had a question to Brian. Why aren't the daycares, as being a sensitive group, why aren't the daycares or any of like the infant children play centers not included in your mapping? Or
yeah,
are you trying to exclude them or senior center?
No, they should be in there. We could just call them care centers for now on that map.
Yeah.
So that includes daycare centers and also elder care facilities.
Okay. Yeah, that was my question. I just didn't see it in the map.
They're called care centers on that map. We're open to clarifying the names on the map. It's not a big deal. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Bianca. Give me a second, Scott. Tom.
Yes. Okay. You mentioned the cooking was mostly commercial cooking. Is that because you don't have a factor for residential cooking for PM 2.5?
No, we do have a factor for residential cooking. It's just that when we look at the whole community overall, most of those emissions are coming from residential cooking based like on our methodologies.
Commercial.
Commercial, yeah.
Okay. On the So for the dairy ammonia, NH3, you have it as 36% of the pie chart. So is that based on an emission factor per number of cows at each dairy or something else?
Yeah, so for farming operations, it shows a cow, but it doesn't only include the cows from the dairies. It looks at livestock overall.
That's what we have are dairies here.
But it also counts if like there's like some free range cattle or anything, any other.
There's no
like,
free range cattle in Kern County. Just,
yeah.
Well, in the hills.
In the
hills, yes.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So it's just a methodology that looks. And most of them is from dairies, and it's it's based off of an emission factor. And we're working with the district on making sure that those are accurate for the dairies that are in this community.
Okay. So a strict 7-mile radius only included about 4 dairies, I believe. Air district. But there's actually 10 very close together. A couple.
Yeah.
Did you look at all 10 of those?
No, that's why we're working with the district to make sure we're including the ones that are outlined. So right now, this only includes emissions for the ones that are within that 7-mile radius,
okay.
Which I believe are 4.
Okay, so that ammonia from dairies could actually double.
Yeah, it's easily. They're not finalized numbers, so it might
be. Because the dairies you're not including are actually the larger ones.
Yeah, so.
And then when you take on the back page on mobile, on-road mobile sources, and you have light-duty vehicles, like the ROG figure is quite large. The NOx figure is a much smaller piece of the pie. But so did you take the Shafter zip code to look at the age of vehicles to get those emissions, the age of registered vehicles in Shafter?
Adrian, do you want to add on to that?
Could you repeat your question?
Okay. When you get the emission data on light-duty vehicles for Shafter or the 7-mile radius, do you consider the age of those vehicles?
Or so, is it, So for the vehicles that are included in Shafter, what we had to do was we don't have detailed information on the community itself. So we took detailed information about the age and the vehicles at the county level. So we applied the county level vehicle distribution and age distribution at the community level. So it's not exactly representing the Shafter community itself. It represents more what's reflective in the county.
So if I told you 35% of the vehicles registered in Shafter, light-duty vehicles, are more than 15 years old, would that change the numbers?
Possibly. I would have to see how that compared against the countywide numbers, but that is possible.
Okay, because that's pretty much what it is, and I was just wondering if you're considering that. And so you took more of a county average?
It's the most detailed level data that we have right now in terms of vehicle age and vehicle distribution. We have it at the county level. We don't have it at the community level, and there are other methodologies in which we're looking into to help inform the community level detailed information for vehicle distribution and vehicle age. But we didn't have time to kind of implement that and utilize that in this time frame.
Okay.
Okay, thanks, Tom. Adrian, if you want to just give Scott, committee member. And Scott, we'll just close this session off with you. You have another one, John? Okay.
Yeah, just to follow up sort of on what John was asking. The draft off-road mobile source graph, that's purely made up representative data, or is it true draft data that you've put together so far? The 1K grid there.
So we've actually looked at different sources that are reported to CARV, and based off of the age distribution and what's the different equipment that is used throughout the Kern County, then we distributed that back into the Shafter community.
Okay, so this is a first pass based on actual data,
Mock-up. Yes, it's based off of various reporting, surveys, and data collection that CARB has done throughout California.
So now I'll pile on to John's question. I live here, so that orange box, almost dead center, is a empty, undeveloped piece of land mm-hmm. straddling over with an almond orchard. And yet you show that as one of the highest 1K grid boxes for diesel PM10. That's, I think, why we're questioning this data.
Okay.
If that box was 2K further south at the intersection of Laredo and Highway 43, I might believe it.
Okay.
But it doesn't. Some of these just don't make sense. They don't.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons we're working on finalizing and making sure like they all make sense, and working with the community to try to figure out if it makes sense, if it doesn't make sense. You guys are the ones that live here and know what's going on throughout the community.
Does somebody from either of your offices, are you going to reach out to get someone to proof this just to make sure it's even in the right universe or for things like this?
Yeah, so you can always email us. We've received some comments in the past based off of that. But I believe Jamie is one.
So I can get to this online now?
No, but you not yet. But in the future, it will be accessible. Yeah. So you can
in a time frame that I can have an effect on the study?
Yes.
Yeah, so you're talking about the actual data behind this, or just the presentation?
Just even the representation of it doesn't appear to be accurate. So how can you get us as committee members to review the data if it isn't available to us before it's locked down and assumed to be accurate, or what we're dealing with, or baseline, or any of those other uses?
Yeah, so part of it is this meeting here to, at least start that conversation. If you see anything, now we know, and ARB knows that, there may be some updating that needs to happen. And so I suggest that, maybe we can send the information out, email to the committee or something, the data that's available for review and feedback on, sooner than later.
Okay. Well, having this data available, just like the layered data on an interactive map, would probably be the most efficient way to do that. Then you just send a link to the committee members, and say, check out the data in your neighborhood and make sure it looks right.
So, Brian, what kind of time frame would that be, do you think? I mean, roughly.
I'm not 100% sure. We'll do it as soon as we can.
Okay.
We'll have to get together after this and see what data is available and then reach out.
Okay.
So Scott, well, why don't we do
so
this?
We'll just make sure we have that as a something to follow up on as soon as we can.
Yeah, we'll put it as a takeaway.
That sounds
tonight.
Great. And I think the visual way of presenting it is right on. That's the way it needs to be. But but without the ability to review it at a granular level, it's tough.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. So John, are we?
I have a couple of questions.
Okay, I've got two more sessions after this, and it's 6:45. But go ahead. Let's just wrap it.
I think this is going to end up being pretty critical to the whole process. In looking at all the graphs, there are percentage. And I'm assuming that's a percentage of the whole, but there's not. I don't see any numbers on here that say what the actual concentrations are. Is that represented? So, if I looked at, well, just any of them, it'll show. PM 2.5, 61% farming operation, 7% all others, and that's a percentage of something.
Yeah, those are mass emissions.
Okay, but anything here that says how much the total emissions are.
Yeah, there's some data behind those numbers that will be available.
But they don't really mean anything from a concentration standpoint. They're just a percentage of the total that's there.
Yeah, so if you look at the table on slide 3, that gives you the total for area, off-road, and each of those categories. So those percentages is
applied to each one of them. Thank you.
Very yes, exactly.
And so on that table that's on page, I guess mine's on page 2, area, I'm assuming the concentrations that are in the area are just the ones that you can't identify where they're coming from there. You're trying to figure those out. Those are the.
Yeah, we're trying to pinpoint those and making sure we have like some estimate, but we're trying to make sure that those numbers are accurate. For those emissions.
So I mean, we have stationary, off-road, mobile, off-road, on-road, mobile, and then area. Areas, everything except for the other three.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Maria. She's got it, John. Good.
Muchas gracias. Me da pena que nos den información de una parte en la que no estamos viviendo y donde estamos pasando los problemas. Les agradezco toda esta información, pero me gustaría ver que es aquí, porque aquí donde dice borrador de fuente zona, habla de una gasolinería, pero si ustedes salen aquí nomás, estamos rodeados de petróleo. Y aquí no hay una especificación de lo que nos contamina el petróleo a nosotros. Es poco el tiempo que nos queda ya. Si acaso menos de 3 meses, porque y pues hemos tenido información, pero no una cosa específica de aquí. Porque la primera información fue de años al 2016. Pero ya estamos en el 2019. Como quien dice, estamos como empezamos. Porque no sabemos hasta ahorita en qué nos pueden ayudar o qué es lo que más necesitamos que nos ayuden. Se nos está acabando el tiempo. Gracias.
Okay, thank you, Maria. Brian, you want to make any comment, Alejandra? I mean, we synthesized the questions here. I think it was more of a statement. Okay. That's it for this part. Thank you, Alejandra. She'll be around for the rest of the evening if the public, again, has input. Brian, staying up. Scott, you want to come on up? So we've got Scott Wall with the Office of Community Air Protection with the Air Resources Board. And Brian will kick this session off with control of emissions for regulated sources. Ariana, do you mind? Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so for my second presentation, I'll be going over what the district's been doing to control emissions for regulated sources. As you know, AB 617 provides opportunities for finding and implementing additional air pollution reductions at the community level. And a big part of that is the steering committee's knowledge of the local environmental conditions and then passing that knowledge along through this process, like we heard here today several times. We really want to call on that knowledge and continue to call upon that knowledge the best we can to ensure we're all finding opportunities for air pollution control through the community emission reduction program process. And so to do that, this presentation is really focused on identifying the clean air efforts in the community to date in a little more detail than we previously have presented, including internet links and where to find additional information on programs. Because I think part of identifying new areas of opportunities is understanding all the existing areas that we're using to control emissions. So first, the district has been here for a while, decades actually, reducing air pollution from stationary sources of air pollution under its jurisdiction. Hundreds of rules have been adopted. Many of them have been amended over the years, numerous times, making the air pollution requirements more and more stringent each time. And there's been significant reductions through all this, which has resulted in facilities reducing air pollution emissions by 85% in the valley since 1990. But of course, there's still emission reductions to achieve, and the district is continuing these efforts to improve air quality. One of these under AB 617 is the best available retrofit control technology analysis that is required under AB 617. I invite you to check out our website here shown on the slide where you'll see all kinds of related information to this effort. There's documents and details on the approach to analyzing our rules to make sure they're as stringent as they can be, what rules are subject to this, and then the district's expedited schedule to analyze these rules. One of the other fronts regarding emission control is our recently adopted 2018 PM 2.5 plan, which demonstrates a scheduled attainment of the federal health-based PM 2.5 standards. The plan includes significant incentive-based control measures, focusing on mobile sources under state and federal jurisdiction, as these mobile sources, as you know, remain the majority of the valley's emissions needed to reduce and meet attainment. The plan does also include other measures to further reduce emissions from certain industrial sources, other things like residential wood burning and commercial cooking. A little bit more on the district's rules that apply to our existing stationary sources. So we have source-specific rules that require emission reductions, and they're organized into categories, so they're easier to find and reference. All these regulations associated with a Roman numeral here that I put on the slide is an entire series of rules. So for example, Regulation 4, there's a set of rules, all 4,000 series prohibitory rules that apply to specific types of facilities or specific types of equipment. And those rules identify emission limits that need to be met, Sometimes facilities needed to make physical modifications and changes to reduce emissions to comply with these rules or implement other operational changes to lower emissions as well. Regulation 7 is another set of rules focused on air toxic contaminants and also implement some of the state's air toxic control measures, like for chrome platers and dry cleaners. Regulation 8 or 8000 series rules apply to fugitive PM10, like dust emissions that get stirred up from equipment in unpaved areas. There's a set of rules that apply to all that. And Regulation 9 is a set of rules that applies to other types of activities that don't necessarily trigger permit application requirements with the district, like our stationary sources do. So, for example, an example of a rule in this category would be our indirect source review rule, where we control emissions from development projects. I'll talk more about that in a little bit. And please, you're welcome to check out our website here for a full and the complete set of district rules and regulations. I put the website on this slide. And then when you do, if you're able to navigate into that, and then you go into the 4000 series rules that I mentioned, you'll see a list of them, and I put them all on the slide here to give you a feel for how many rules we have for specific types of operations. I think there's almost 100 here, 90 or so. But again, these are rules that have been amended over the years, becoming more and more stringent, and they apply to many of the or most types of operations, facilities, and equipment that we have here in the Valley. And to name a few, we have a rule specifically for boilers, another one for dryers, refineries, composting, animal farms, painting operations, and so on. And so then when opening up any one of those rules to check out what it's specifically applicable to and the requirements, the first thing you'll see is all the amendment dates that the rule has gone through over the years. These two rules here on the slide apply to stationary engines, as a category of air pollution, has seen requirements go through 13 amendments over the years. And as mentioned, you know, each one is focused on improving air quality in the Valley, and in many cases, requirements becoming more and more stringent. And it's because of rules like this and many others shown on the previous slide, the stationary source emissions in the Valley have improved so drastically over the years. So I've been talking mostly about existing sources and the rules that apply to those types of facilities, but the district also requires new and expanding businesses and operations to go through a strict permit application process. And this process may culminate with the issuance of a permit from the district with enforceable conditions on it after it has gone through all the checks and where we can ensure that the requirements will be met. So in that process, one of the main checks to go through, or one of the main mechanisms the district uses to minimize emissions from new and expanding operations, is Rule 2201, or a new source review rule. And the primary component of that is BACT, or best available control technology. And that requirement of BACT is exactly what it means. It's the best of it. We require the best available technology and equipment to be put on the proposed operation, and if it's been done anywhere, then it's the most stringent air pollution control there is for that type of equipment. That's going to be the new requirement, and it's always an ongoing process to keep ACT as stringent as possible. Through the permitting application process, we also assure that no violations of an ambient air quality standard will occur as a result of this project, as well as no new health risks will be created as a result of the project. And then also the larger stationary source projects require a public noticing process along with an associated public comment period, so that we make sure we understand and know everything about the project that maybe some of the where local knowledge may be needed. And then again, in performing that analysis, if any of those requirements aren't met, The permit won't be issued by the district. We would either basically cancel that application, deny it, or continue to work with the facility for them to propose changes to their application to continue to reduce emissions until all these requirements are met. Regarding toxics, the district utilizes several mechanisms that combine. We call our integrated air toxics program for the valley. I mentioned district rules on stationary sources, such as the new source review rule and all the other prohibitory and toxic rules. But the district also implements federal and state regulations through the same permitting process, where any related requirements, such as MACT, NESHAPs, and ATCM requirements, will end up on the permit as enforceable conditions as well. And then in addition to all that, the district implements AB 2588, which is the state's air toxic hotspots program. Under this, stationary sources are required to submit information about their air toxic emissions, the type of emissions they are, and the quantities of emissions, so that local health risks can be determined from those sources. And then the regulation, AB 2588, is also designed to be a public right to know a regulation where the local public will be informed of any significant health risks from any one facility, and that facility may need to reduce its emissions to acceptable levels. And then finally, and in fact, one of the most significant methods of reducing air toxics has been through the incentive grants programs. Most clean air projects, such as fireplace retrofits and diesel engine replacements, reduce not only criteria pollutant emissions, but also toxics. So as mentioned, the district's grants programs have been key in the valley's reducing emissions, and will continue to be vital in achieving emission reductions, including mobile source reductions. Many of these programs are aimed at replacing older, higher emitting equipment with newer, cleaner technologies. Many of our programs have been open for years and continue to be available. We put some examples of our programs on this slide, which are split into three main categories: incentive grants aimed at businesses, public agencies, and the public or residential. And for more information on these programs and others, you're invited to visit the website shown here, valleyair.org/grants. And in addition to all that, there are still a few more ways to achieve emission reductions from mobile sources. So now the district can't regulate direct tailpipe emissions, but we've made extensive efforts to gain emission reductions indirectly. One of these efforts is the creation of the district's indirect source review rule that was first adopted in 2005. It's the first and only rule of its kind in the nation that requires mitigation of emissions from new developments in the valley. Which the requirements are based on a cleaner fleet average for the project and an overall cleaner project. One of the other measures that we've created is a voluntary emission reduction agreement contract process, or VERA for short, where developers can enter into a contract with the district. Under these VERAs, the developer provides mitigation funds to the district, and then in turn, will fund clean air projects on behalf of the developer. The district has an ETRIP regulation that large employees can implement alternative transportation measures, such as carpooling. And finally, the district provides comments to public agencies through its CEQA process. Now, the district doesn't have any authority on land use decisions. So to be involved in that, it's more of a commenting role, and we'll ensure that public agencies or the CEQA lead agency is informed about district regulations such as ISR, our permitting rules as mentioned, other opportunities such as our VERA program, so that we're taking all opportunity that we can to improve the air. And that's actually the last slide. That's all I have. And so I'll pass it to Scott.
Give me a minute here to get the slide deck up, please. Good evening. My name is Scott Wall. I am with the Office of Community Air Protection with the California Air Resources Board, or CARB. And I am here tonight to actually introduce to you some of the statewide strategies that CARB has already implemented and some that we're going to be that we're working on for the future to help control emissions statewide. And I'll try as best I can to kind of introduce you to ones that that we see as a little bit more relevant to Shafter as we go along here. Little disclaimer. First disclaimer is I usually like to stand up and do this because I've got a lot of nervous energy, but between a mic and a clicker and my notes, I just can't seem to juggle all of that. So I'll do it seated. Another is that I am not a regulatory guy. So my role within the Community Air Protection Program is as a community liaison. So I am actually the liaison assigned to Shafter, and what that role really requires is that I make connections with the air district, coordinate meetings, I connect connect all the internal folks at CARB that are working on the different elements of the AB 617 program in Shafter. I interact with residents, community-based organizations, and other sister agencies, such as when we brought in Department of Pesticide Regulation, I was involved in kind of coordinating, bringing them into the fold and bringing them to the table as well. So as I go through the information I'm presenting to you tonight, I know I can scratch the surface and I can talk a little bit about it. But I, by no means am I a specialist in any of the stuff that I'm talking about. We're going to be talking about a lot of different regulations and plans. So this is not new information. I know for some of you on the committee that have been actually following CARB for a number of years, and you could probably do this presentation better than I'm going to do it. I'll just put that out there. But really, the purpose of this is just to be an introductory level of the statewide strategies that CARB is putting on. And what I'd like to do is call your attention. There's a second handout besides the presentation that we sent. All of the different strategies, plans, and regulations that I'll be talking about tonight are actually in this handout. So there are links. Once this gets posted to the district site, you'd be able to download it and link out to any of these kind of specific plans and programs or regulations that you're interested in learning more about. So I will be just scratching the surface of what we're doing. And also, in your Community Air Protection Blueprint, Appendix D and F, I believe, also go into more detail about these strategies that we'll be talking about tonight. So just a quick refresher on kind of on what the different air quality agencies, who they are, what they do. At the federal level, the US EPA sets and enforces the national air quality standards, regulates interstate transportation like trains, ships, and planes. At the local, Brian just got through kind of talking through some of the things that the local air district does. And so they regulate stationary and local sources of pollution, factories, refineries, residential wood stoves. And then CARB, the agency that I work for, we basically are responsible for regulating mobile sources of air pollution, greenhouse gases, and consumer products. There are some exceptions, which might touch on those a little bit more throughout the presentation, but this kind of generally speaking, we are responsible for cars, trucks, buses, and basically air toxics as well. We have a lot of air toxic control measures. So just to touch very briefly on some existing regulations and control measures at CARB, I am not going to spend any time on ports because it's not really anything that is relevant to Shafter. So there is more information on ports in the handout, and again, you can find it online with the links on the handout I've given. But the four that we'll be talking real briefly about is rail, mobile on-road, mobile off-road, and other toxics. These are all kind of relevant to Shafter. Some existing regulations with CARB in rail is cargo handling equipment. So basically at rail yards, these would be the cranes, the yard trucks, the container handlers, forklifts, and drayage trucks, which historically have been kind of the higher polluting, older model trucks that do the short runs to get the goods basically from the rail yard to warehouses. So we currently have existing regulations with cargo handling equipment and drayage trucks that are seeking to reduce emissions from those sources. And in mobile on-road, we have the truck and bus regulation, which is basically focused on upgrading, retrofitting, and replacing polluting engines. There's the heavy-duty vehicle inspection program, which is random roadside inspections, basically to verify that diesel engines don't smoke excessively, and that basically the controls in the emissions haven't been tampered with. These typically are held at like border crossings, CHP way stations, fleet facilities, and they sometimes are also conducted at just roadside stops. And then there's also the truck idling control measure, which that restricts diesel vehicles from idling more than 5 minutes and also not in school zones with limited exceptions for that. In the mobile off-road control measures and regulations, we have regulations geared toward the transport refrigeration units, which are basically typically the diesel generators that help keep perishable goods and things that need to be refrigerated cold in transit. And we do have control measures on that, and we'll talk a little bit later about some upcoming kind of future-focused additional controls that we're looking at doing. The off-road diesel vehicle regulation, which again, that is a regulation that is focused on off-road diesel engines used in construction and mining. There's idling limits, there's restrictions on older vehicles being added to fleets, and we're also requiring fleets to reduce emissions. And then finally in the mobile off-road is the small off-road engines. These would be the things like the lawn and garden equipment, typically things less than 25 horsepower. And then finally, under existing regulations and control measures, we have kind of some other toxics control measures. There is a chrome plating control measure, which basically requires facilities to reduce emissions by requiring the use of chemical fume suppressants and or add in controls to meet stringent emissions limits. And then there's also the composite wood control measure, which composite wood is basically things like hardwood, plywood, particle board, fiber board. And so this regulation actually aims to reduce the formaldehyde emissions from those materials and from finished goods made from those materials like cabinets and flooring. So that's pretty much the existing regulations and control measures that we wanted to highlight today. And as we look at the statewide toxic health risks, we can see the benefits of these regulations that we've already implemented. And so these regulations and control measures, you can see here when you look at diesel particulate from the 1970s to today, the diesel particulate has basically been cut into roughly a fourth of peak values. And thanks to control measures on gasoline formulation, consumer products, solvents, and other sources, the combined cancer risk from the six of the largest contributors besides diesel particulate in toxic air contaminants have also drastically been reduced. That is not to say, of course, that when we look at a statewide, we obviously know we're here because it's not, these benefits have not been achieved in all areas, in all communities. So black carbon basically comes from soot, from diesel exhaust, wood burning, and industrial processes. And it's both a health concern, and it's also a short-lived climate pollutant, which lends to climate change. And as you can see here, the black carbon concentrations have declined continuously, initially because of bans on waste burning, a shift to cleaner fuels for power generation, and other measures that are intended to reduce the health risk from fine particles. Recent efforts have targeted black carbon for reduction because of its contribution to climate change. And as I kind of hinted on a little bit earlier, when we look at fine particles in Kern County, so this is actually more of a local, it's as local as data as I have available to me. When we look at the fine particles in Kern County, you can see here that when we look at the National Ambient Air Quality Center, the federal standard, that Kern County is still trending, obviously, above that standard. And I think that really helps to paint the picture of why we're here today and why AB 617 was created. Another driving force of the AB 617 and Community Air Protection Program is really trying to understand even more locally than the county level what's going on within the local communities. And so hopefully we'll be able to get a better picture of what that looks like that's even more detailed than this graph here for Kern County. While we've come a long way from a statewide perspective and even made some headway within the valley, we still have a long way to go. And in the next few slides, we'll take a look at our recent and upcoming strategies aimed at further reducing emissions. So CARB's governing board has adopted several comprehensive air quality and climate plans in recent years. These include a suite of emissions reduction strategies that will address many of the sources that are concentrated within heavily impacted communities. So the two plans that I've just highlighted here, they focus on mobile sources. One is CARB's mobile source strategy, and the other is the multi-agency California Sustainable Freight Action Plan, and that establishes clear targets to improve freight efficiency and a transition to zero emission technologies. The next two they focus on CARB's effort to curb pollution that contributes to climate change. And I think of particular note for the Shafter area is the short-lived climate pollutant plan. And that really is focusing on the dairy and other livestock emissions that we've heard as concerns, and landfills, and oil and gas systems. And the most recent plan, of course, is why we're all here, the Community Air Protection Program, which you all hopefully received a copy of the blueprint that kind of is the guidance document for this program. And this is really recognizing the fact that while we've had really remarkable improvements in air quality statewide over the last 50 years, that there are still areas experiencing a high cumulative exposure burden for multiple sources of air pollution. And as you know, it's a community-driven program to deploy air monitoring and emission reductions at the community level. So we're hoping that together all these plans will provide a foundation for additional emissions reductions needed to deliver healthful air in communities with high cumulative exposure burdens. So looking at the proposed, these are kind of plans that are in the works or going to be coming near, kind of to a theater near you, if you will, coming up soon. They're kind of on the arrow is showing the expected board consideration and adoption, and then kind of the arrow showing when the implementation is expected to begin. But you'll see that when you look at like innovative clean transit and advanced clean trucks, advanced clean cars, zero emission drayage trucks, those are really all specific programs that are helping kind of focused on driving the markets toward zero emission vehicles and zero emission technology. There's also working on amendments to the smoke inspection programs, working on implementing regulation for the heavy-duty onboard diagnostics, and also amendments for the heavy-duty inspection and maintenance. Those are the summary of the mobile source measures. And then the off-road mobile source measures, same thing. I've kind of grayed out the ships at berth and commercial harbor craft, not real relevant to Shafter. But coming up in the off-road is we're looking at zero-emission transport refrigeration units, small off-road engines, again, kind of the lawnmowers and lawn equipment, reduced idling at rail yards, zero-emission cargo handling equipment, and then emission reductions from non-preempted locomotives, or which is basically the older, more polluting locomotives. And so there are plans in the works for all of those. And then finally, there are also additional proposed control measures on some toxics. Chrome plating control measure amendments are in the works, looking to further kind of work on cleaning up chrome plating operations. Composite wood products, while we have currently regulations in composite wood, there are amendments underway to help further the measure, the controls on composite wood products. And then CARB will also be developing a commercial cooking suggested control measure that the districts can use as a model and implement at the local level. And these don't really have any expected board consideration dates. They're plans and being worked on right now with no deadline on them at all, no timeline by which at this point we can share that they're going to be done. And so that pretty much wraps up. There's my information on the slide there, and I am available. I can connect you if you have any more information about any of the stuff that I've touched on very briefly. I'm the one that could connect you with the right person to share that with you.
Thanks, Scott. Ariana, do you mind? Thanks. Tom, got a quick question?
Okay, so we just heard a lot of local rules and regulations and plans. I'd like to point out a few inconsistencies I see in those in the Shafter area. First of all, it is very puzzling to me that I'm going to say there's a dozen oil wells around Shafter that are pumping, that have pumps run by internal combustion engines. And every one of them is within an eighth of a mile or less of the power lines. Likewise, on my farm right now, if I want, I can disconnect my electric motor pumping water and install a diesel engine. Now, I know it has to meet all the regulations. Why would I be allowed to do that? It doesn't make sense. And there are dozens of these internal combustion, let's say there's 20 or so of these internal combustion engines on farms right around Shafter, very near, within an eighth of a mile or less of the power line, some of them disconnected in the last 10 years that are pumping water. There should be a rule against that. Another rule, a fireplace rule. The Air District is paying people to install EPA-certified wood stoves and then allowing them to burn on days that are nearly twice the health standard for PM2.5, up to 65 micrograms when the health standard is 35. That makes zero sense. These EPA-certified stoves, if operated exactly right under very special conditions, they are cleaner than the older wood stoves they replace, but they're dirtier than an uncontrolled old diesel truck for the same amount of heat they're putting out. They're filthy, and they're putting cancer, toxic chemicals into homes and into neighborhoods. And you're allowing them to burn when the air quality is way above the health standard. That's another rule that doesn't make any sense. Finally, you mentioned the short-lived climate pollution plan, and you mentioned dairies, and I assume methane digesters part of that. Well, I can take you to a dairy just a few miles from here that has a methane digester,
And now to use the gas, they've installed an internal combustion engine to make electricity. So our air quality is worse because they installed a methane digester. It has done nothing to help our air quality. It's actually made it worse because now they're burning an engine to produce electricity. That same dairy installed 5 acres of solar panels to produce electricity at the same time. Yet they're being paid by CARB $1 million to make our air worse, just to collect some methane that actually isn't bothering our air quality. So some of these things don't make any sense for this area.
Not to argue with my friend here, but I'm assuming that zero emissions technology is electric, predominantly electric, or is that what we're referring to?
I would say that a lot of the mobile equipment these days is running on electric zero emission vehicles, but it's not the only one that's out there. There's other types of zero emission technology out there as well.
And I mean just an observation that in California, 40% of the electricity is produced off of natural gas generation. So, I mean, it's not really zero emissions. And actually, I think at some point, Jimmy, in this analysis, I'd like to get some sense for how we actually produce energy in this area. Because we generally think that if it's an electron coming out of a wire, it didn't get here, through some sort of hydrocarbon. And California is highly dependent on natural gas. And frankly, natural gas reduced the carbon emissions more than anything in California. And then my only other question is that, I mean, we as a AB 617 community, we are a community that I think what we think is that we have a higher accumulation of air pollution, at least in this area, than other areas. And I would like to have some sense of a baseline. If you went any place else in Kern County and checked the air quality, how that actually compares to the air quality here in Shafter.
Thank you, John. Any other thoughts on this presentation, Gustavo?
Yeah. Again, thank you very much for the presentation. I think it was on Brian's. Yeah, Brian's presentation. On the mobile source emission reduction, kind of like under the incentives piece, there was a voluntary emission reduction agreement, the VERAs. Is there any like statistics or any data available on how those VERAs have contributed like positively to Shafter? Like, has any of those clean air projects actually been deployed in Shafter? And has there been developers or industries that have paid into the VERA from Shafter? And is there like a return on investment on that? And is there any breakdowns on like where that VERA, like monetary financing, or where all the money goes? Is there a breakdown on like what the projects specifically are and like who benefits from those projects?
We actually publish that in the annual report every year. So we have that available on our website. It has, I believe, all the information you're talking about. We list all the projects that we fund and so on. So we can definitely provide that internet link to that annual report.
And it has, like, the geolocations of, like, where that is distributed?
I don't think it has this actual spatial data on where it is, but it identifies the project.
Cool, man. Thank you. And then on this, I think it was the third slide on decades of stringent air quality regulations. I know that in the email, I'm not sure if it was for like the general public, but for the steering committee members, I believe a week or two ago, they emailed the CARB's oil and gas methane rule regulation fact sheet. How does that new methane rule, because I see a lot of it went into fruition, implemented in January 2019, how does that play into this kind of, because I see like leak detection and repairs and like this, like LARDs, like programs that have already started. like, is that playing a part into this overall, like, 617 project in Shafter?
I'll let Vernon Hughes handle that.
Yeah, thanks, Gus. Yeah, I think that may have been, and correct me if I'm wrong, we did get a question that from Tom regarding that rule, and we sent some information along, and I'm not sure if I haven't been tracking, I apologize, whether that was an email that came out of that, a response to Tom's. Okay. Yeah, so again, like Scott mentioned, we're not experts in all the rules. We could certainly get more information to you all on that particular reg. And I did provide in that email text, I believe, some contact information. If that isn't enough, we're certainly able to get you, you know, directly contact in contact with the LDAR folks.
Anyone else?
This is on the Brian's presentation, where you said regulation AB 2588, air toxic hotspots. How about for the upcoming air toxic process that have, okay, well, let me go back. Like the chlorpyrifos that is going through a process of an air toxic contaminant, would you also classify that as a hotspot? Being that in Kern County we are heavily used on chlorpyrifos.
So that AB 2588 regulation is solely for the stationary source permitted type operations. If you're referring to other things that aren't under the district's jurisdiction, like pesticides and other things, no, that regulation doesn't cover that. So that would be some other process for us to like gathering the information with through DPR's help and the ARB's help. We would, you know, look for those other mechanisms to gather that information. Hotspots is, or the 2588 version of hotspots is for permitted facilities.
Do you mind if I?
Yeah, help. Just go ahead, help.
This on. Hi. So regarding chlorpyrifos, it was declared a toxic air contaminant. And then last week, CalEPA announced that it's banning chlorpyrifos in the state of California with a 2-year gradual cancellation of all registrations.
Yeah,
true. But the mitigation measures passed last fall will decrease usage. But I see what you're saying. 2 years.
Okay, anyone else? Great, thank you, committee members. John's just got a short update on air monitoring network. And Brian, thank you. Scott, thank you. Don't go anywhere, just you guys stay close. Alejandro, we're gonna close this out and the public may have some questions, but John, go ahead and take it away.
Thanks, Jimmy. Hi, everybody. I'm John Klassen, Director of Strategies and Incentives at the Air District. Just want to take a couple minutes here to give you all a quick update on the progress we're making on implementing the Community Air Monitoring Network here in Shafter. So last month, we had a short discussion on it. We went through some concepts, showed an initial design of the network for Shafter, got some feedback from the community here, and so with that, we've been talking to different properties in the areas, trying to get some logistics completed to see where we could place the monitoring equipment, looking for secure access, places with access to power. We're making progress with that. We're having meetings down here with different areas, so we are making progress. And once we get some of those logistics worked out, we'll start installing some of that equipment in those areas that we showed on that initial map. We're also continuing to work on a visual representation of the data that will be collected here in Shafter. We're working through that, getting that set up. That will be available on our website once we have that done. We'll keep you updated as we progress through that process. We're also continuing to work with CARB staff on getting the data that we collect here in Shafter integrated into their statewide data portal, which will show monitoring data being collected here in Shafter, as well as throughout the rest of the state. So we're working through that as well. We'll keep you updated as we make progress. And finally, we are working on drafting the community air monitoring plan document itself, which will describe in more detail everything that we'll be doing here in Shafter for air monitoring, describing where we will be monitoring, how we'll be doing that, how data will be available to the steering committee and the public. Once we have that draft done, we will share it with the committee here. We hope to have it done before our June steering committee meeting. And if we get it done before then, we'll send it out through an email to the group here so you can look at it. Maybe at June we can get some feedback on that document before we finalize that in July when we have to have our network up and running and ready to go. That's it for my quick update. Thank you very
Thanks,
much.
John. Anybody else on the committee? John.
On the monitoring program, and I just have and I apologize. I mean, how we set that up is somehow going to enable her to tell us whether or not the ammonia came from the dairy 7 miles away into Shafter.
So we'll be measuring pollutants at different locations in Shafter with wind direction, wind speed. So that'll help us backtrack where emissions could have come from for various pollutants.
But the fingerprint that she was talking about, we're not going to have a system in place to actually do that.
For ammonia specifically?
Well, anything that would exactly tie it to that particular source.
Oh. Yeah, that's a modeling process that we can go through, and with the data we collect from the air monitoring network here in Shafter, that will assist with that sort of analysis.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, anyone else? Great. Thank you. So I just kind of want to conclude tonight's meeting. Just talk briefly about some takeaways. Clearly, we picked up that there needs to be a little bit more two-way communication, especially with information that needs to be provided in real time. Scott brought out an issue of making sure that prior to anything being implemented that the city of Shafter would like some input. Brian, we just got to make sure that you and Scott and John are all dialed in, okay? So maybe offline after tonight's meeting, whether it's email or specifically, you could comment on the website. Tom's got some issues, some factual issues with regards to some of the information. We need to address that. Again, Cynthia did take note. And for the public, after the meeting, we've got a posting of not only questions but also statements, which we'll also be posting with regards to public comments. Gustavo. Okay.
So I think part of the suggestion was, like, is there, and like, the data transparency, like, is it what we're being presented, like, factual?
Okay, I'm sorry. I picked up that Maria had an issue with regards to the issues of the petroleum.
Do we need an additional meeting before the timeline? Because we look at the timeline, it's very aggressive. We're step one of five. And so, like, in the future, do we need to send a doodle for, like, the steering committee members to see if we need to get through that, or are we just going to rush through this process?
No, I think, Gustavo, I think one issue that we could discuss is a what we'll call a subcommittee meeting with regards to the timeline. It's something that you folks can drill down on, and we'll be talking to Jamie and the air district about your thoughts on that. And Maria, we did pick up your thoughts on petroleum surrounding Shafter and your thoughts, but we thought it was more of a statement than a question. That's about it, Cynthia?
I just want to make sure I captured Gustavo's. Do we need an additional meeting to discuss timeline? Is that?
Yes.
Okay. But it was on Brian's presentation. Is that correct?
I think it's on the surface, yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay. I'm sorry, Tom.
I don't know who's setting these agendas anymore, but at the next meeting, some of us would like to present our concept of a community emission reduction plan for Shafter, because time is running out. These plans that come out of this committee have to be submitted to CARB by the end of the summer, by August or sometime there. And at the rate we're going, we're not going to have a plan.
So
we're going to default. We're going to default to whatever the air district wants to do, and that's not right. So here's what I want.
Sure.
At the next meeting, some of us are going to present. Anybody is welcome to, of course, our idea of a emission reduction plan for Shafter. And we want to meet in 2 weeks after that to discuss it further, because there's no time to really feel these plans out. But whatever's presented at the next meeting needs to be discussed in depth very shortly thereafter. So I would suggest 2 weeks after the next meeting, we have another meeting to discuss our proposed community emission reduction plans.
Okay, so Tom, let me ask you, do you have a blueprint that you've already designed?
We're going to have it for the next meeting.
Okay.
And if we can get that 7 days in advance, we can have it ready to go. We just need some time to make sure that we get it translated and printed and all of that, but we can definitely do that at the next meeting.
Well,
Tom, hold on, Tom. So when you say get it ready to go, what does that mean specifically?
We need something to us 7 days in advance.
Okay.
That's the commitment that we have both to this group and to the Fresno group.
Because we put...
I'm sorry?
Like the last request you did, go ahead and send it out.
Yep.
7 days prior, before we meet.
We send the agenda out 7 days in advance, so we need it 7 days in advance to put it on the agenda.
Well, just put it on the agenda that we're going to present something. I can't promise we'll have it 7 days ahead of time,
but we need it ahead of time. Second
meeting 2 weeks later.
Right,
where you will have 2 weeks to look at it, and then we discuss it
Tom,
in depth.
Tom, hang on, Tom.
We need it ahead of time.
Yeah, so what she's asking for is on June the 3rd, the blueprint that you're talking about. It's we've got a process here. So do you think you can have something to the district who's setting the agenda with your blueprint that needs to be circulated to the entire committee and to the public? That's what we're asking.
Well, I doubt it. It'll be ready for the next meeting, though.
The 10th, but
We need it 7 days in advance.
Yeah.
So if we don't have it 7 days in advance, we can kick it to 2 weeks later. And you guys can present it 2 weeks later, and then we can meet about it in July.
It's not going to be that complicated. We're going to present something, but we want to discuss it in depth 2 weeks later, exclusively for that purpose.
And we are 100% on board with you guys presenting it, and then 2 weeks later, discussing it in depth. But we need it ahead of time. There's lots that goes into this whole process of printing and translating and all of that.
We'll be able to present it. I'll even bring a PowerPoint, but we'll present it.
We got to get it posted to the website. We've got to make sure that the public has access to it. We've got to get it translated.
Put it on the agenda, please.
So, Tom.
I want to be crystal clear, though, here, Tom, that we cannot put it on the agenda unless we have it in advance. So we can maybe push that if we get it the Wednesday before the Monday, that maybe we can make that work. But there is a lot that goes into it. We'd like to have it so that our facilitator is aware of what's being said, that the public can see it on the website ahead of time. We've got to get it translated. This is a public process, and so we need it in advance. So in order for it to be on the agenda, we need it, let's say, not 7 days in advance, but the Wednesday before the Monday. So that is...
Tom, it's not unreasonable. So we'll just, you know, we're not, there's no... Yeah.
Right, and if we need to push it to the next meeting, we can have meetings every week, if you guys want to have meetings every week. We are sensitive to the fact that, you know, people are busy, but we can meet every single week if you guys want. We can meet twice a week if you want to meet twice a week. Whatever this committee decides they want to do, we can do. But we can't get something. We have this problem in Fresno. I can't get something the morning of the meeting and make it happen for that afternoon.
No. Okay. All right. Thanks, Tom. I think we got some clarification from the district. So we're not opposed to the plan. We just it's a timing sequence. It's a legal issue. It's a process. So if you can get it to Jamie. Well,
to start at 7, do we want to start at 6:30? We spend a lot of effort and time discussing this stuff over and over and over. And like I agree with you guys. We go ahead, we put it for the agenda, let them give time, put down what we're going to talk about. If not, I will meet the following week.
Okay. Thanks, Brad.
And Jimmy, just to comment on the timeline too, the focus over the coming months is to focus on developing the community emission reduction program. We're going to be spending the majority of our time talking about that over the coming months. We're going to go through a lot of exercises with the committee to get good feedback, develop it together. So that's the real push now going forward, is to develop that important part of the program.
Okay, thank you, John. So we've come to the conclusion. We'd like to take this opportunity for the public to comment. There are microphones that Cody will have. If we can, if you just would like to get up and state your name and what organization you represent, and any questions to any of our panelists are over here to the left of me, whether it's CARB, the district, et cetera, please, this is your opportunity. We're running a little behind, but we think it's important. Patty,
yeah.
If you want to.
I am with the Kern County Farm Bureau. So I was asked by several farmers to attend this meeting because of some of the discussions that have been going forward. So I'm kind of here my first time. But I do have some questions for most of all of you who did presentations today. The first one I want to kind of ask is, I guess you're doing a map that's going to show the areas that you're working, that you guys did a diagram for the Fresno area, and you indicated where the, I think it was the Air District. Question for you, could you also indicate on that map the employment numbers? So when you talk about those areas, I think it would be interesting for people to know the employment numbers associated to those facilities as to how many people are employed in those areas. I think that makes a huge difference also, if you could do that. Is that possible?
I'm not sure we have that information, or I don't think we have that information, but we can take that comment down for consideration.
Because most of those facilities have permits. I think part of the permitting process, they do ask in your applications how many people are employed. I think that's real important for us to understand what employment numbers are associated to those facilities.
Yeah, I don't recall that as something that we do as part of our process, but we can look into that.
Right. Also, too, no one mentioned the impacts of the train in the middle of the city. So it'd be interesting to find out what that impact is to the train when it does come through, the mobile sources off the train itself. Also, to the fact that you have idle traffic waiting for the train to go by. So I'm interested to see what would happen if there were grade separations in those locations and how much that would improve the air quality as far as mobile sources, since the train actually divides the city in two. So I'd be interested to see the impacts that train has on the community going forward, because I think that would benefit the community both air-wise, greenhouse-wise, and traffic-wise.
I'm sorry, and Patty, is in your bucket, my assumption is that this grade separation, there's monies that
Section 190, absolutely. Okay. It'd be something for us to tap into. And then I also know that CARB also uses that as a benefit. The other reason, too, is I noticed that you guys talked about the ISR and the VERA rules. It would be nice to have those dollars only used in the county in which they originated in. Right now, you do not do that. Right now, you mix all the money and you spend it in the valley. But it would be beneficial for those monies that are paid here out of Kern County are actually used in Kern County, because those are the projects that are being built, and they're the ones paying for it. So it should be nice if we could keep those dollars here in Kern County if they originate in Kern County. Also, too, when you do take and you talk about mobile sources, it would be interesting to know that Kern County does have a lot of aged residential vehicles. So that does impact this community. So when you talk about emissions from mobile sources, you should consider the age of the vehicles. That is, you will find out that the residential in this community, the vehicles are older. And there are some vehicles that are not registered, so they're not going through emission testing as they are required to be. So I think that you should take that into consideration as well. You cannot do that in the ag industry. The ag industry is not allowed to have vehicles outdated per the San Joaquin Valley's rules and regulations for ag equipment. So be careful that we're not making ag require and not the other way around. So that's important.
So, Patty, hang on. We've got VERA, we've got grade separation, age of vehicles, and a couple more. Go ahead.
Let's see here. And then when you talk about the emissions, the wildfire fires in the last couple of years contributed heavily to the contaminants in this valley because of the way the air travels. So our worst days that we had in 18 and in 17 were not caused by local activities. They were caused by the wildfires up north. So how are you going to take that into account? That as you say you're going to monitor the area, will you be able to know exactly if that smog or contaminant is coming from Northern California and it reaches here in southern in the Southern Valley? Because that's what happens. Is the air just happens to float. That's the way it is. It just travels. So I just wanted to make sure that that was also being considered.
Just hang on, Patty. John, do you want to?
Yeah, real quick, that's a great question. The worst days we see for PM2.5 in the valley are from wildfires. With the monitoring that we'll be doing, if we do some PM2.5 speciation, we can look at the component that was from carbon from fires, and we can know when those impacts happen, and we can try to separate those days to make sure that we know that doesn't represent normal air quality conditions.
Okay, just wanted to double check on that. When you talk about the air, the ag source, you guys showed that ag sources were a major contributor. Was that for the entire valley, or was that just for the area that you are looking at for the city, for the scope?
So ag is currently, that inventory is collected under the area source protocols, and it's just for this presentation, it was for the 7-mile radius of Shafter.
So that ag source was just for the 7 miles within
Correct.
This area?
Yeah.
Within the defined boundary.
Correct.
Right, but it takes into what account? I mean, what is it that you're using as your assumptions?
So ARB can correct me if I'm wrong here, but depending on the type of source, there's different methods for collecting that inventory. So if it's dairies, there's some methodology for collecting those emissions. It's county-based. It may be the number of animals reported. And then, so you'll have some emission factor times, you know, some number of animals, in my example, for the county. And then knowing where the locations of those dairies are in the area here, those emissions are attributed to those.
I'm not worried about dairies. There's very few in the 7-mile radius. So if you're taking the dairies, it's out of the area.
Yep.
Most concerned about.
I'm just giving you an example of the approach. And that same type of thing is done for all the different types of operations that fall into the areas.
You have a comment?
Yeah, so it's, Brian said it's based off of data that's been collected as to what is the different type of crop around or throughout California in the valley. And it looks at like a historical data, and then based off of that, we have emission factors related to each of those processes.
So you don't take into account the actual reality of what's happening here in the valley. Because the reason I say that is that are you looking at crop types? Are you looking at harvest times? Are you looking at? I mean, those are the kind of things, and you can those assumptions can be vastly different in parts of the state.
Yeah, I believe those are taken into account in the methodology overall for each of the different areas.
So are you taking into account, are you contacting the ag commissioner here and asking him what is grown in the sphere that you're using?
Yeah, I think I need to double check on that to make sure. I think maybe Brennan has more information related to that.
Because that would be advantageous. To know exactly what it is, you know, because there is data to show what is grown in this area.
Sure. Patty, if we could just maybe take you and some of the other leadership staff offline, if you guys want to huddle. I we appreciate all your questions. I just want to see if there... Okay. Okay, hang on. I'm not trying to cut Patty off. We all appreciate the Farm Bureau's input. Is there anyone else, though, just in light of time, that's got a quick question before we... No.
I have
Okay, so Patty, how much more do you have before we? Okay.
Sorry, this is my first time, so I apologize.
Let's go. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I was just going to comment in terms of methodology. That is something our admissions inventory group does have the methodologies documented, so it sounds like that would be helpful to have a pointer maybe to the methodologies that are used to develop the inventory. That would be informative to you.
Especially in farming, because when you talk about pesticides and you talk about the crops and so forth, and our ag commissioner is sitting here today, I think it would be advantageous if we're going to do this and we want to benefit the community. I think it's best if we benefit the community with all the right data. I think that makes it a better success, because I think that's what we're all here for, is to try to make it as successful as we can. So I think the more accurate the data, the better success will be. Okay. And I think you'd be willing to provide as much information. Yep. And I know as a Farm Bureau, we would as well. So I think that the better we have, and I do know for a lot of you, if you have, you know, the connection between us and the farmers who actually farm here, if we need to ask them what kind of tier vehicles they have on their fields, we are more than happy to do that as well, because they have to have the proper, you know, equipment to run, so they have to have the tiered equipment. They have to have exactly what's necessary for a ag well pump. So if we need to help in that way, so you have the correct data, we're more than happy to help that way too.
Great, thank you, Patty. Just let me hang on, Patty. Heather just wants to talk, address a question that Maria had during the session.
Yeah, since this is my first meeting here, I'm not sure what you've already talked about, but I just wanted to call to attention CARB's new study, the SNAPS study of neighborhood air near petroleum sources, because Lost Hills, which is not that far away, was selected as the first community to have its air monitored specifically to try to understand the impacts on health from the nearby oil and gas production, and their air monitoring is starting this month. So hopefully that information could be used to help inform potential impacts in Shafter as well.
Okay, thank you, Heather. So for committee members, your name badges, and hang on, place cards when we conclude. Just make sure we put them back on the table. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is John Haley. I was just wondering, you hear about these unregistered vehicles. You know, you hear them at meetings all the time. Does ARB or anyone have technology to read license plates and compare them to the vehicle that it's registered to and then take action on that? And also, does ARB have mobile portable monitoring equipment to measure emissions from vehicles as they're going down the road? And can they deploy that to do monitoring?
So you're equating unregistered vehicles with older vehicles? Because we were...
If you don't register, if you don't ever have smog.
Got it. Ryan, Alejandro, Adrian, you want to address that? You just give him the mic. It's regarding unregistered vehicles.
So in our countywide model, we take into account, at least, you know, because we're applying, I'm going to talk generally first, that the countywide emissions, we take into account a certain percentage of unregistered vehicles, and that's based on a county level. And then for us, we applied that to the regional level. But we do have other ways to look at finer scale things. And one of the things you mentioned was license plate readers. And one of the things we are trying to do and introduce into a lot of the AB 617 communities is automated license plate readers, where we do set cameras and then read the license plates. And then we would get the vintage, the age, and the distribution, the type of vehicle that's going through the community. From that, we could run it across DMV and truck databases and figure out age and whether they're registered. And then from there, we could possibly pass that on to enforcement. This is something, kind of a new technology, so I'm not saying that we would do that. This is something we're exploring the use of. But that is a possibility that you mentioned. What was your other part of the question?
Portable monitoring equipment where they actually set it out. Vehicles drive by and it measures the emissions and then notifies you if it's not good. But if it is good, that you're also allowed to like not even do your smog test if you don't, you know, if you're scheduled to have one. So is that kind of, is that being contemplated by the ARB?
So we do have other, you know, this is, we're going a little far from my field of expertise, but there are things called, there's this one system called PEAKS where they actually have setups that, that measure your emissions at, you know, stoplights and at intersections, and they can get the emissions from the vehicles. That we do have mobile monitoring. I don't want to go too far into this because it's going far afield, but we do have that technology available. And if this is something that's interested in the community, we could possibly have experts from CARB come out and talk about it.
Thank you. That's it? Okay, June 10th. We'll see you at 5:30 for the next meeting. Thanks, folks, for your input.